Welcome to the House Judiciary Committee. We apologize for our late start, as we do every day. We're going to start today with Senate Bill 47, and I'm going to open a public hearing on that bill. Before I do, I'll announce to the committee that I'm due at 2 o'clock in a meeting involving some public safety issues, so I'll be turning the gavel over at 2 o'clock, and I'll try to make it back before you're done, but otherwise, whichever one of you wants to wrestle for the gavel when I leave the room, or do you want to handle it, Representative Anderson? Then I'll let you run the rest of the meeting until I return. So we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 47, and Mr. Snyder and Mr. Swank. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. And the Association of Oregon Counties and the Oregon Judicial Department agree on Senate Bill 47. And what the bill does is to relate back to the year 1999 when legislation was passed that would, effective July 1st of the year 2003, create interest on delinquent criminal judgments, and that interest would go to a number of different places. One of the problems that we encountered with respect to that bill, though, was had to do with the intentionally delayed effective date. We felt we needed 4 years in order to put this in place without any adverse fiscal impacts. And as time progressed, at least the Judicial Department seemed to be on track to get that done before special sessions came along during the current biennium. One of the problems that Municipal and Justice of the Peace Courts had with respect to this had to do with the fact that we have four different levels of fines and assessments in the statutes, and the top level must be paid completely before even a nickel is credited to the next layer down, and it goes on down to the second, third, and fourth tier, so that calculating and posting interest is a lot more complicated than it would otherwise seem to be. Notwithstanding that, we thought we would be able to put this together, and the purpose of one of the purposes of this legislation in 1999 was to create a small funding stream for court facilities, because that's where the state revenues would be dedicated. And as you already know, court facilities is a large and growing issue that we share jointly with the Judicial Department. But where we've wound up now is that in part because of budget cuts, in part because of difficulty of posting and crediting the interest payments, we come to you reluctantly asking you to postpone, once again, the effective date of that legislation. We're not ready to put it in place in July of 2003, either at the local minor court level or at the state circuit court level. We think that with 4 years, we can put this together without a significant adverse fiscal impact and still get us to where we want to go.
Mr. Swank.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank, Special Counsel for Government Relations for the State Court Administrator's Office. I don't think there's anything I can really add to what Paul has said, other than to agree with him. It's not something that can be done now. The resources aren't there. The people are, in fact, no longer there to do this, so we're asking that it be set back for 2 years to give us a shot at doing it. And I can answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions for either Mr. Snyder or Mr. Swank? All right, I hear none. Thank you, gentlemen. Is there anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 47? Close the public hearing. We'll open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
I move Senate Bill 47 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson moves Senate Bill 47 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Okay, Ann, you want to call the roll?
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Excused.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Kozanski?
Excused.
Representative Shetterly?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. Senate Bill 47 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative McPherson, would you like to carry that?
Be fine.
Thank you. Okay, we are now going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 189. Counsel, you want to explain this first?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Senate Judiciary Committee had two bills relating to speed racing, and Senate Bill 189 is one of those bills. Patsy should have just passed out Senate Bill 90, and she just passed that out for your information. That's the other bill related to speed racing that came out of the Senate Judiciary. That bill is in Ways and Means. This bill would create a new crime of organizing a speed racing event and would make it a C felony. There is currently a traffic offense of speed racing. It does not expressly apply to organizers. I almost said organizers. So this would make a felony for those organizers, and as you can see, 90 is a misdemeanor crime for the drivers or other participants.
All right, and we have Troy Costellas from ODOT is here, and also Mr. Mainwaring, if you're here. Why don't we start with you, Mr. Costellas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, committee members. My name is Troy Costellas. I'm the manager of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Senate Bill 189, as council has described, does have a similar bill in Senate Bill 90 that Senate Judiciary reviewed. Senate Bill 189 comes to you from the Oregon Transportation Safety Committee because they were requested by local neighborhood associations, by local traffic safety committees, by officers, and by parents to address the issue of those that organize a street racing event. Late 2001 and in early 2002, there were several young people killed in the Portland area in relationship to street racing events. And in having conversation about those cases, there were concerns because some of these were pre-planned. They were talked about on websites. They were talked about through flyers, people using pagers to communicate back and forth about the events. Those involved and were victims in some of these cases did not have the ability to address the organizers. This original bill started out as a Class C misdemeanor in the Senate Judiciary, and the committee itself raised it to what you see today as the Class C felony. We're not talking about participants. We're not talking about spectators. But we're talking about those that go about in a pre-planned fashion in order to hold the street racing event. Senate Bill 90 deals with some of those others, and it was sponsored by the City of Portland. And we do have confirmation from the City of Portland they would be willing to strike the organizer piece out of Senate Bill 90 so that the two bills are not in conflict. Mr. Chairman, there's clear message needs to be sent to the people that are organizing these things, putting predominantly our young, new drivers at risk in some of these events, and would ask for your support of Senate Bill 189-A.
Thank you, Mr. Costellas. Mr. Mainwaring.
Yes, Mr. Chairperson, members of the council, Earl Ray Mainwaring, nicknamed Smokey. I actually represent Families Against Speeding Drivers, FASD. It's an organization we established here in 2002. A little bit of history. I'm a school bus driver. I'm not here to discuss the budget, as you well know. I got a new computer the other day. I know a lot about computers. I think a bite is something that happens to a mailman when he delivers a letter inside a closed fence with a mean dog. That's about what I know about computers. As a bus driver, this young lady right here lost her life at age 19. Tricia Ann Thornton. I knew Tricia very, very well. I was her bus driver, had her on my bus for 6 years. The parents tell me that if they had any idea that Tricia had been traveling to Portland, Oregon to attend car shows and street races, maybe the parents could have done something to sway her thinking. But unbeknownst to the parents, for 3 years prior to her death, nobody contacted parents because nothing was done to stop this behavior on our public streets. I believe that this bill will not only educate people, but people have a right to know who's involved in organizing street races, and there should be accountable punishment for this type of behavior. It's very unsafe behavior, and it costs lives, it costs bodily injury, and property damage. This is one of the things that creates our insurance premiums to go higher at the same respect. The worst thing about this whole scenario is, I can tell you this is a true story, because I am the person that received the phone call at 2 o'clock in the morning on the 19th of January. Trishy is my stepdaughter, and we miss her dearly. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson, Council.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mainwari, for coming and sharing your personal story with us. Mr. Landauer from the City of Portland.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Mr. Chair, Mark Landauer with the City of Portland's Office of Government Relations. Mr. Casales is correct. We did introduce a bill, Senate Bill 90, which is presently sitting down in Ways and Means. But as a result of that bill, Senate Bill 189 is before you. I believe it makes it a Class C felony to organize street racing events. We've had a tremendous problem in the metropolitan area with speed racing events. But during a three-month period of late 2001 to 2002, there were five fatalities in the city and outlying area due to street racing events. A number of other people injured, some critically, as a result of street racing events. We are attempting to come down rather hard on these types of individuals that engage in this very dangerous behavior. We were hopeful that 90 would assist us in doing so. Regrettably, it does have a pretty significant fiscal impact and is sitting down in Ways and Means. We do think that 189 will bring at least some sense of containment to the problem, but ultimately we want to go after the drivers, and we will continue to work on Senate Bill 90, but with that said, 189 certainly does address one facet of the problem. Be happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions for any member of this panel on the testimony? Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Representative Kremel, then Representative Ackerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that the with the definition for speed racing event, that legal racing types of activities won't get inadvertently caught up in that. I do notice that it says takes place on any highway, but I just want to make sure that we don't have any situations in the state where we have Grand Prix types of events that actually take place on public roads, but they've been closed. For the event.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, you will note on line 10 it says takes place on any highway. Senate Bill 90 is actually a little bit more broad in that it goes on any highway or place open to the public. So, for example, and I have heard recently that sort of some car enthusiasts that do race antique cars, for example, will race on very large parking lots. Our bill would capture that. This does not. This deals with the highways of the state of Oregon. So Senate Bill 189 does not deal with, for example, PIR or privately owned parking lots that are open to the public where these events sometimes do in fact take place.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
You may.
I guess what I'm trying to get at, though, Mark, is that And I don't know if there's any communities in Oregon that have Grand Prix type of events that they've actually planned. They close the course. They do all the things that are appropriate. But I want to make sure that they wouldn't be that a community that had that type of an event wouldn't be legal or guilty of basically violating the law.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cromwell. Senate Bill 189 does refer on line 9 back to the current law of street racing, speed racing, which contains a list of seven different items in relation to drag race, not allowing to pass. There's a lot of other things that take into account, which I think rule out the situation that you're referring to.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Ackerman.
Am I reading this right, that an organizer of a speed racing would be more culpable, that is, subject to felony status, than a participant, because a participant might get just reckless, assuming no injuries? And what's the rationale for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, good question. The current penalty for a speed racing, a violation of 811.125, is a Class A traffic infraction, I do believe. The committee in the Senate heard testimony both on Senate Bill 90 and 189 concurrently, and just felt compelled that the organizers who were putting together these types of events should be perhaps held to a higher standard. It was an interesting conversation that took place, and ultimately they put Class C felony there. I can't necessarily give you a strong reason why, but there's certainly an underground nature to this type of activity where people are using computers, cell phones, various sophisticated communication devices, whatnot, to get these types of crowds together to engage in this type of behavior. And as a result, the committee was interested in seeking a rather stiff penalty for those people who do organize these type of events. I can't really give you a stronger stronger reasoning why.
Yes, you may.
And also, the Ann Gross bill limits it to activities taking place on highways. That gives me two questions. Why are you limiting it to highways rather than to also premises open to the public, when you say that this has some underground secretive type characteristics? You could go off at some abandoned place and have an organized race. Why not punish those people? And secondly, is a highway too narrowly, I don't know if we have a definition statutorily of highway in Oregon, but is that too narrowly drafted? How about an arterial street?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Ackerman, first to the limiting it to highway rather than premises open to the public. That was also a debate in Senate Judiciary, and some of the concern in question was, just as Representative Kremel had brought up, is would this extend to PIR or the drag strips and places like that? So the conversation was, instead of having the debate about whether those properties are in or out, if we limit it strictly to the roadways in the state, you're not going to have that conversation. So that's why they changed the wording from open to the public to the wording that you see in the bill today, which is any highway. And I lost the second question that you had asked.
Yeah, you say it takes place on a highway, and I haven't had time to determine whether that's statutorily defined. But suppose we had a speed race on an arterial street. Do I get off?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, the highway in this case is using the lowercase h, which means any roadway, city, county, or state facility in the state of Oregon. So the arterial, a city street, as well as a county road or a state highway would all apply under this definition.
The reference, Representative Ackerman, is to highways defined in 801.305, meaning every public way, road, street, thoroughfare, and place, including bridges, viaducts, and other structures within the boundaries of the state, open, used, or intended for use of the general public for vehicles or vehicular traffic as a matter of right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lewis. Further questions? Representative Prasansky.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I guess Mark and for ODOT, the issue that Representative Crumbles brought up, I think, is a significant one that you want to include, because if there is some community that's going to do a street race that's been sanctioned as part of an event, that they don't get caught up in this. And there could, in fact, be a Grand Prix type of race in one of the smaller communities, and I think you could just have an exception built into here, and just making certain that it's properly licensed and approved.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brzezinski. Again, this issue was just recently brought to me by a car enthusiast who also happens to be a racer, who also just happens to be a lobbyist as well. And I certainly assured him that if, in fact, Senate Bill 90 gets any wheels, so to speak, we will attempt to address his problem.
And I think that not only 90, but also 189.
189.
All right. Further questions? One of the things that we're still waiting on, we have a fiscal, I don't know when this fiscal is going to be, council. So we've got a May 1 fiscal, and it's a little difficult to really understand what they're suggesting the impact of Senate Bill 189 would be. My recollection on the fiscal on Senate Bill 90 was 200,000.
Yeah. I believe that was right. Correct.
Council?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think the difficulty with 189 is there is no crime for the organizer at this time. So what they've done at fiscal is, I think that makes it hard for them to determine how many violations of this crime you would have. What they're saying is that it's indeterminate at this point. Here's a quote, if 15 persons are sentenced to probation in a biennium, the cost could be significant. So I think I talked to Ms. James, and it was hard for them to figure out what it would be, but they do have some concerns about, you know, when we look at how many speed racing convictions there have been, I think it's been over 1,300 for 1 year. You know, so it is significant. And incidentally, those are written around the state, not just in Portland. There's a significant number in several areas around the state. So they do have some concerns about how well they're able to determine the fiscal impact on this.
Okay. Well, I think what we'll do is we'll...
Mr. Chair.
Yes, I'm sorry, Representative Barker.
Yes, just one quick thing.
Yes.
The way it describes a person organizing and pre-planned, would that be... If a kid's a passenger in a car and tells another car, let's get out of downtown, go meet me on the Ross Island Bridge for a race, would he be a felon under this?
Ms. Chair and Representative Barker, it is a possibility to do, as you say, it would be incumbent upon the officer to have preponderance of evidence to raise to the level of this versus in the current statute of 811-125, which would be the Class A.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, I think what we're going to do is we're going to not take this bill into work session today, in part to get some clarification between 90 and 189, and particularly to address the issues that Representative Crummel and Plazonski raised. And I guess I'd like to have a conversation a little bit more with LFO about what they actually think this is going to cost. In the meantime, we appreciate your testimony, particularly you, Mr. Mainwaring, for coming and sharing your personal experience with your family. And you certainly have our sympathy for your family's loss. Okay, thank you. We'll now close the public hearing on Senate Bill 189. Okay, we're going to skip Senate Bill 269 for a second, and we're going to go to a public hearing on Senate Bill 304. Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 304 is a district attorney-sponsored bill, and this bill would allow a waiver of any youth to adult court if both parties stipulate, if the attorney for the child and for the state stipulate to waiver of a youth to adult court, that can be done. I believe the testimony was that would normally happen when there's been a serious charge filed against the youth, and then negotiations occur where there's an agreement to have, the probation or some other part of the sentence done in adult court.
Okay, and we've got Mr. French, Ms. Russell, and Ms. McFarlane. Welcome. Why don't we take them in that order? We want to start with you, Mr. French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Al French. I'm a senior deputy district attorney from Clackamas County. I'm here on behalf of the District Attorneys Association this afternoon As counsel said, this is a District Attorneys Association bill, and I don't have an awful lot more to say than counsel said. We believe that it would give us flexibility, particularly in ballot measure 11 cases. As you know, ballot measure 11 is a very black and white bill, as is most of the criminal law, and life experiences are a lot grayer than the law as written. And a lot of times we feel that we need some flexibility in dealing with young people who violate the technical language of ballot measure 11 statutes. And we are sometimes constrained from doing that because of these limits on what cases can be waived.
Mr. French, maybe if I could ask, it might be helpful for the committee if you could give us either a real-life fact situation where you can change the names to protect the juveniles involved or the young people involved, or just give us a hypothetical where the district attorney would want to avail themselves of this kind of flexibility.
Mr. Chairman, one of the things, if you have had a chance to look over the statute, the amendment is very minor, just adds a new paragraph to it, but you will note the absence of any sexual offenses on that. Presently, there is an absolute defense to statutory sex offenses if there's more than 3 years if there's less than 3 years age difference between the parties. So, if a boy and a girl have sex and they're 2.5 years age difference, that's not a crime. If they're 3 years and 1 day age difference, it is. So, actually, if they're 2 years and 364 days, it's not a crime, and two more days in there, and it's a crime, and that's 75 months sentence between no crime and an extremely serious crime. So that would allow us the flexibility to perhaps negotiate the case to a rape in the third degree or attempted rape in the second degree. There aren't any attempts on here, so that would be in any of these Class A or B felonies. We could use the attempt statute, which is frequently done with adults. Another example might be rape in the first degree requires forcible compulsion. That is a very black and white phrase, but again, in real life, a lot of times forcible compulsion and lack of consent is a very gray area. And sexual intercourse without consent constitutes sexual abuse in the second degree, which is a Class B felony. A Class C felony, which is not on the list. And that would be another situation where you might want to go that direction.
Okay. Ms. Russell.
Susan Russell, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're here also in support of Senate Bill 304. It is our belief that this would be a great advantage and tool for the parties to use in dealing with cases that either are charged as Measure 11 or could be charged. And there are other cases that fall outside of that ambit in which this may also be of benefit. We believe that it is well drafted as it is. It requires the stipulation of the parties. We believe that this will be used to the benefit of the defendants in the criminal justice system. And we do not support any amendment to that language limiting it to Measure 11 offenses because we believe that that may not allow the parties to negotiate the case early on and resolve it, short of it being indicted for Measure 11 and then having to require sort of more complex negotiations. As it is, it allows those type of cases that are gray to not come in as a Measure 11, which would require the defendant to be held in custody to post a significant amount of bail, and allows the parties both later in the negotiations and maybe early at an information stage or pre-indictment to try to negotiate the case so as Mr. French has pointed out, so that the penalty can more accurately reflect the nuances of the case and the sympathetic factors that may apply.
Okay, and so I'm keeping tabs on the scorecard. District Attorneys Association doesn't support the limiting amendment, the dash ones, is that right?
That's correct.
And yeah. OCDLA doesn't support the dash ones.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. And I bet you, if I ask Ms. McFarlane, you're here in support of the Dash 1 amendments, am I right?
That's correct, okay. Chair.
All right. Why don't you tell us your position, and then we'll open it up to questions for the panel.
Julie McFarlane. I'm a senior attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project in Portland, and we also support Senate Bill 304. We think that it's a very important tool in negotiation of Measure 11 cases, and they are very often difficult cases to negotiate because of the limitations on waiver. So we do want to see these changes that the District Attorneys Association has proposed. However, we think that there is a problem with having the language as broad as it is, so that a change which was in fact limited to Measure 11 cases would be helpful, but when we start getting into having it apply across the board to any types of cases, then we as defense attorneys, first of all, are going to be obligated to tell our juvenile clients, you may want to ask to stipulate to a waiver on this very minor charge, because nothing is going to happen to you in adult court, or you're going to be on bench probation. And in juvenile court, you're going to have a probation officer who's going to follow you, going to make you go to school, going to make you obey your mother, and going to make you do treatment. And our clients will say, well, I'll take the waiver. Even though you tell me it will be bad for my record, I will take the waiver because I don't want to be made to go to school. I don't want to be made to obey my mother. And I don't want to have a probation officer. So we're going to be in that dilemma. And I think that this is very appropriate for Measure 11 cases. And the more serious kinds of cases that District Attorney French was talking about, but I'm concerned that it's also going to apply to every minor case that comes down the pike. And there are, I think the District Attorney will probably agree with me, there are a number of cases where you get, you have something pretty serious happen to you in juvenile court that, you know, virtually nothing happens to you as an adult when you're processed as an adult.
Okay. Questions? Start with Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McFarlane, what would keep the state from stipulating in a case that's other than a Measure 11 crime? What would keep the state from stipulating to the waiver? I mean, what would make the state stipulate to the waiver?
Well, perhaps the I'm sorry, Representative Crummell, Chair Williams. Perhaps the idea that they're getting a more severe consequence because it's an adult adjudication, it's going to be on the record. And I think very often when you have kids who are sometimes committing multiple crimes, building an adult record is an important factor to a DA.
May I follow up?
You may.
So you have one of these gray areas, that, and the defense the defense says, well, we want to fall under this bill, but the prosecuting attorney really feels that it's going to be best to make this juvenile obey his mother and have a probation officer and have to go to school and have to have treatment and that sort of thing. I mean, that's really what's in the best interest of the child. Then can't the prosecutor then say, no, we will not stipulate to that, and we want this young man or this young woman to go through the court system in the juvenile system because they're going to get the things that they need to become responsible citizens?
Chair Williams, Representative Crummell, absolutely, they can do that. However, in my experience with stipulating to waiver, I have never had a district attorney refuse to stipulate to waiver. And I think that, you know, it's just viewed as giving the juvenile a more onerous consequence. And so I feel that they would not do that.
Maybe we need some training for the DAs. Thank you.
Anybody else?
I'm just a little confused.
Yes, Mr. Barker.
So the amendments allowed only for Measure 11 crimes, limited only to a Measure 11 crimes?
Representative Williams, Representative Barker, that's correct.
I'd be interested in hearing sort of a response from both of you, Ms. Russell and it slipped my mind, I apologize. Mr. French,
sorry,
I apologize. I'd be interested in a response from your perspective to the point that Ms. McFarland was mentioning, which is that in some instances there might be sort of better, more lasting consequences for this juvenile not to waive up, but that they'll be obligated from a defense standpoint to give them their options, and so they'll waive up into adult court only to find that ultimately they get a lighter slap on the hand with less supervision kinds of experiences as a result of that waiver, and how that factors into the position that both your organizations have taken on the bill. You want to start, Mr. French?
Thank you, I will, Mr. Chairman. I must say that I think that there's a possibility that some of that may happen. I think to a large extent that you'd have to rely on the district attorneys using their good discretion in the case. And I think that if in a scenario as Ms. McFarlane set out, that the district attorneys probably would not want to do something like that, and they would not do it because they would be exercising their discretion properly. I think that more likely you would find a situation where the district attorney's perception was not that the juvenile would be, you know, closely followed and by a juvenile probation officer and made to do things he didn't want to do, but more likely that the district attorney's perception would be that the juvenile probation people are not going to be doing any particular a close supervision of this child anyway, and so that it would be a wash as far as that part of it went.
Okay.
If I can speak to something else real briefly, Mr. Chairman, I didn't have a copy of the amendment when I spoke before, and I share Ms. Russell's concern about the way it's drafted, that it would require us to file ballot measure 11 charges before we could get into this exception, and once those charges are filed and the ball starts rolling, sometimes it's more difficult to get out of ballot measure 11 than it is to avoid it on the front end. When ballot measure 11 charges are filed, at least in Clackamas County, indigent defense costs are a lot higher because they're based on the charges that are filed, not on the ultimate resolution. And as Ms. Russell said, there's ballot measure 11 have mandatory custody, and those expenses are high, as well as, of course, being limited to the defendant. So I'm concerned about the way that that's drafted. If the committee thinks that it should be somehow limited to require the filing, the actual filing of the ballot measure 11 charges before this kicks in.
Okay. That's helpful. Thank you, Mr. French. Ms. Russell.
Hi, Mr. Chairman, Katie. I guess we're talking about hypotheticals of what would happen. I understand Ms. McFarland's concern in terms of DAs presently not being willing to accept the stipulation. At present, we're talking about more serious offenses, and the limits into the reason we're here is that there are very few charges on which an individual, a juvenile, can stipulate or be waived into adult court. I again would think that it would be unlikely that a district attorney would take a juvenile or would stipulate to a juvenile on a misdemeanor case, for example, or a property damage case going into adult court, knowing the kind of services that are involved and are available in juvenile court. We're talking about, in most counties, my experience has been juvenile district attorneys who work in juvenile court do not work in adult court in the bigger counties and are very sort of very proud of the services that are available to juveniles and are reluctant to have juveniles transferred in adult court. So I guess we're talking in hypotheticals. I guess if it does become a concern, this is always something that we, if in practice it plays out different than I think what Mr. French and I anticipate, it's always a matter that can be redressed in terms of addressing those circumstances or limiting it. But I think that to simply limit it at this point on a hypothetical where we've got really no experience, and when both the parties with experience in adult court can really see how this amendment would really put a hamper on seeking the objective of this bill, I think would be sort of premature.
Thank you. Ms. McFarland, why I mean, what would be the motivation if a district attorney understood that the kind of supervision relationships that you're talking about that could occur at the juvenile court level? I mean, what would first off motivate a district attorney to be willing to let that happen? In other words, wave up to adult court when they would likely know that in the situation you're describing, maybe there wouldn't be the same level of surrounding support services and supervision and all those things that the juvenile may not want. And then secondly, doesn't the statute actually give the judge ultimately the discretion? So if the judge looks at the deal, doesn't the judge have the ability to say, you know what, ultimately you guys can agree to it, but if I think it's not either in the best interest of the state or in the best interest of the juvenile, I can decide not to let the waiver go forward. I mean, isn't that sort of a safety valve on this as well?
Representative Williams, I think that, to answer your last question first, I think indeed that the judges do have the discretion to take a look at these. Again, though, I have to say that in my experience of stipulating waivers in juvenile court, I've never had a judge turn one down either, and they just pretty routinely go through. In terms of, I'm sorry, I forgot your first question.
The first question was, I guess I'm still trying to understand what the motivation would be for a district attorney to actually waive up into adult court if he actually thought the level of supervision and other issues were not going to be as sufficient there, what the motivation would be.
Well, Chair Williams, I think it's one of those dilemmas, and I think that D.A. French mentioned a little bit that perhaps there would be a belief that there isn't going to be enough supervision, or that the supervision is going to be less stringent in juvenile court. But also, I think there might be a strong belief that a little jail time could have, in an adult jail, could have a very strong effect on a juvenile as opposed to the treatment in juvenile court. And I think that that will be persuasive. And ultimately, you have a juvenile coming saying, I want to be waived. I don't want to cooperate with the services in juvenile court. And I think a lot of DAs will say, what good is it going to do me to oppose this? I might as well let them go.
Representative Ackerman, then Representative
I want to expand upon a point the chair made, because the way I read existing law, before a waiver is effective, you have to have a hearing. So I think, would my construction be correct that if you wanted to stipulate to a waiver, that it would still require the hearing and the imposition of the same sort of court inquiry that would otherwise take place?
Is that correct?
Whatever.
Chair Williams and Representative Ackerman, no. In my experience, there's a written stipulation or an oral stipulation, and a full-blown hearing that covers all of the issues is not held.
I'll just follow up, Mr. Chair. I think if that's the construction, then I do think we have at least a conflict on the face of the existing law with what the intent is expressed by the witness, because the way I read it, it could be read that before a waiver can be approved, there has to be a hearing under ORS 419C349. And then under that, it's all these subsections that the court must consider, and one of these is existing Bill 304, which says you can waive. So I think we have a problem of construction, is my point, and I feel more comfortable if the waiver is made pursuant to a hearing rather than just a youth coming in and the state saying, yeah, this is what we want to do. That's my feeling about it. I think we have a problem of statutory construction.
Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, I would agree with you. However, when we're in there and we're representing a client who wants to stipulate to a waiver, we're not in a position to be arguing that the judge should have a full-blown hearing on the child's sophistication, maturity, and amenability to treatment, which is waiver hearings are pretty lengthy, big hearings that include expert evidence and so forth. So we're not in a position to demand that, and in my experience, it doesn't happen.
Thank you.
Can you either one of you address the issue of the hearing component? I mean, can these waivers be done by written stipulation without a hearing, I looked up the statutory language in the existing law. It says the juvenile court, after a hearing, except as otherwise provided. And I looked up the otherwise provided language, and 364 seems to be a waiver in future cases, which says that there's been an order entered saying you can waive once, you can sort of waive in all the future cases with respect to that juvenile, and so you don't have to go back and visit that waiver issue over and over again. And then the 419C370 that it cites is waiver of motor vehicle, boating, game violation, and property cases. But I don't see anything that looks like it's sort of a carte blanche. If both sides agree and sign on the dotted line, you can get the waiver without a judicial hearing. Are we reading this wrong, or is there something else in the code that we're missing that isn't referenced by the bill? You have to have a hearing in front of a judge for these to be effective, I guess, is what I'm asking. Either one of you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my experience is that you do not, that you can waive the hearing.
Counsel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It might be helpful to explain how Measure 11 crimes are handled in adult court, because I think there might be a confusion about a measure. You know, when a person under 18 is charged with a Measure 11 crime, and then also, Mr. Chairman, the one waiver you mentioned is, I think they call it the blanket waiver for traffic, and that's, you know, that would be for adult crimes, or excuse me, for, I think the policy behind that was that juveniles were prosecuted in adult court, and really the historic policy behind that, I believe, was kind of what Ms. McFarland said, was that in those traffic cases, the youths were having to do more stuff, jump through more hoops in juvenile court rather than adult court. That has changed a little bit since we have more felonies now that are traffic crimes, like felony elude, felony hit and run, that I don't think were in place when that started. But I think that might help the committee to understand the relationship of this with the serious crimes.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Counsel, Representative Ackerman, I give an example. I mean, a hearing, I guess we're talking about a hearing where witnesses come in and give testimony there's that kind of thing. I don't think there's a requirement for a stipulation to adult court that there be that type of hearing, sort of the classic hearing. What happens with a juvenile, let's say a juvenile is charged with Measure 11 under present law and the parties work out an agreement that it's appropriate for the a juvenile who's in adult court, because it's a Measure 11 charge, that the appropriate resolution would be for the juvenile to plead to one of the listed offenses or Class B or A felony, then what would happen is there'd be a stipulation that would be drawn up. But in that, the court would have to make findings and the parties would stipulate to the findings. There's no independent hearing in terms of witnesses being called, but the different factors would be that, Ms. McFarland mentioned some of those, that the juvenile is not best suited programs that are available in juvenile. So there's a number of factual findings that would have to be made, including that the juvenile is best served and that the programs are more appropriate in adult court than juvenile court, or that the juvenile would not benefit from juvenile supervision and juvenile court resolution. So in a situation where, the parties, where that's not true, when somebody is on a misdemeanor or a property offense, that kind of thing, I think, then it would be a problem, I think, for the parties, for the district attorney, for the defense attorney, and who's representing the individual, and also for the court to basically sign off on a stipulation which says X, Y, and Z, all of which is that there are no, the services are not, that the child is not amenable to services in a juvenile court.
But ultimately, the court reviews the waiver and has to make some set of findings to determine whether or not the waiver was in fact appropriate.
Mr. Chair, I think that the court, for the most part, will make a determination that the juvenile understands what the options are. Whether the court will make an independent determination as to the services. My experience on these, particularly when we're talking in the context that I've had experience with Measure 11, is that the judge will talk to the attorneys off the record invariably in these kind of cases, in terms of the resolution, they're really agreeing to put the juvenile, and they'll want to know why it's appropriate in these circumstances, why it's appropriate to take this case out of Measure 11, why it's appropriate to put it back in. So I don't think in these kind of cases that the courts at least when we're talking in the Measure 11 context, that the courts don't take their responsibilities seriously. I don't have the experience that Ms. McFarland is talking about, which is sort of people that are starting in juvenile court and never were in the adult court context. But talking about the experience I have, there really is a significant number of findings that the court has to make. And for the court not to inquire as to whether those findings exist, I think would be sort of a disregard of the court's responsibility in this context.
Mr. French, do you have anything to add?
Mr. Chair, not really. I think that she stated it very well.
Okay. All right. Well, are there any other questions? Did you have a question, Representative Planowski?
Well, I guess I just wanted to follow up because I heard a statement about maybe the youth would be doing time actually in an adult facility. My understanding is that if they're convicted of Measure 11 up until age 18, they stay in, under the youth authority, and then they're transferred at that point, or there's a decision made as to whether they should be transferred. Is that not the case? I mean, do we have 15-year-olds, 16-year-olds that are actually in adult facilities?
Chair Williams, Representative Prozanski, this is talking about regular waiver. So the provisions that cover Measure 11 don't apply. And, in fact, these kids can be held in adult jails and sent to OSCI or what would be OSCI.
You're in charge. Do good.
Okay. Any other questions? Hearing none, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to speak on Senate Bill 304? Okay, hearing none, I'll close the hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 304.
Mr. Chair, are you wanting the Dash 1 amendments or?
I personally would like to. I think our chair was open to moving it either way. I understand that he would like it without the amendment.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and make a motion then to move Senate Bill 304 as it is to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Any discussion?
Let me just if I may, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I appreciate where Ms. McFarlane is trying to go with this, but I don't feel in my own mind, and maybe I need some more education on this, but I don't feel in my own mind that the case has really been made that making the that keeping making it only for Measure 11 crimes and not for a little bit broader case. And I think that the bill, the way it's currently written, is probably the way for it to go and have the best chance of passing in the House.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Hearing none, clerk call the roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Excused.
Representative Lazonski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Excused.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Excused. The Senate Bill 304, having a constitutional authority, is declared passed.
Carrying?
Yes. Do we have any volunteers?
Oh.
Yes. Saw your hand up.
Oh, my hand wasn't up. That was Representative Prozanski's hand in front of your face pointing at
by
me.
Osmosis.
He just didn't want to have to care.
61 and 269,
let's do that at the end. We'll do these two.
59 is not right, so we've got 19.
Okay. All right, let's hear Senate Bill 19 for a work session.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 19, you had testimony on this, I think it was a few weeks ago, on May 5th. Senate Bill 19 is the bill that deals with housing youth offenders in jail. Larry Oglesby is here, Carl Myers is here, Timothy Travis is here, and Julie McFarlane is here. You should have before you, I think there's two amendments that people would like to look at. There's the A4 amendments that I think Timothy probably could speak to these. I know because Nancy Miller requested I have these put in. These amendments would don't really go to the bill. It looks like it's more of an attack on amendment and a technical amendment with the Citizens Review Board. Who is going to be on the Citizens Review Board for juvenile law? It would clarify or limit who can be on there from DHS, making clear that it would be someone who's a person who provides child protective services. That's on page 1, line 21 of the A4s. And then on page 2 of the A4s, you could see that this is dealing with how the state court administrator can receive funding for the Citizens Review Board. So Mr. Travis, I think, is for this, for the A4s. Ms. McFarland has the A2 amendment, and I'll let Ms. McFarland discuss these. These did not come, I think these must have come from the chair, and so I don't really have them, and I don't know what they do. So, Ms. McFarland.
All right, Ms. Travis.
Timothy Travis with the Oregon Judicial Department. The Oregon Judicial Department is in support of the A1s and the A4s. The A1s are the original rewrite of the bill that was done after the initial testimony on the Senate side. The chair over there asked the work group to get together to write the bill to everyone's mutual satisfaction, and the A1s are that amendment written to everyone's mutual satisfaction except for the Juvenile Rights Project. Their satisfaction is the A2 amendments. The A4 amendments, as the council said, are sort of a tack on. They have nothing to do with the substance of the bill in terms of putting people under the age of 18 or over the age of 18 under the jurisdiction of the juvenile court in an adult lockup. They're merely here because the relating clause is good. The A4s, as counsel said, have to do in part with who can be on a citizen review board. Citizen review boards are citizens who are volunteers who review the cases of children in foster care and youth offenders in some OIA placements. The statute that you have in front of you that's being amended is a conflict of interest statute, if you will. It is intended to keep people who work for Child Protective Services off of the Citizen Review Board panels that review the cases of the kids who are under the supervision of that agency. Line 21 on the first page of Senate Bill 19A4s, line 21 says a person providing child protective services employed by the Department of Human Services. Until last session, that reference to the Department of Human Services said SCF, the Office for Child Protective Services within DHS, because as you know, DHS is an amalgam of...
Mr. Chairman, can I...
Please.
Timothy, I think I want to make sure we're on the same track. When you said the A1 amendments, are you referring to what, the engrossed bill? Is that what you're referring
to? No, the engrossed bill, there's an A1 amendment to the engrossed bill that is called the A1 amendment.
Okay, I want to make sure. I don't think the committee has that, Timothy, okay. So I want to make sure we have that. Can I get a copy?
Sure. I don't have anything I wrote on it either.
If it was an A1, it would have had to have been. This would have to be a B engrossed version. Then.
So that's the bill that we have in front of us.
Okay.
I could be more confused, but at this point, but it would be difficult. I apologize. The A engrossed version does include the A1, the 19-1s. I apologize. So let me backtrack and say that it's the A engrossed version and the A4s.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I've only been doing this for about 12 years now. You think I'd know what an Annie Gross version of a bill was, wouldn't you? Anyway, as I was saying, the A4s, originally, we didn't have to say that people who worked for TANF or people who worked for mental health didn't have to be, could not be on a citizen review board because we said SCF, which was then a division of DHS. What happened was in the last session, as you recall, those of you who were here, everybody who works for DHS is now called DHS. So with the stroke of that name change, a whole bunch of people who used to be eligible for the Citizen Review Board were no longer eligible. And what this does is that this says only those people working for child protection are ineligible for a Citizen Review Board because there's no conflict of interest if you're in mental health or if you contract with mental health. So that's what that piece is about. And the second piece of the bill, which begins on line 16 of page 2 of the A4 amendments, our financial people tell us that 419A128-2, as written, does not allow the Citizen Review Board to receive contributions. But our financial people tell us that the amendment that we're seeking to that statute does allow the Citizen Review Board to receive contributions. And the main thing that the Citizen Review Board is interested in is their own members being able to contribute to the Citizen Review Board to keep their trainings going. So that's what the A4 amendments are about. And I'm very sorry for confusing the situation. So if there are any questions, I'd be pleased.
We'll hold those. Thank you. Ms. McFarland.
Chair Anderson, members of the committee, as I testified at the public hearing on this bill, the Juvenile Rights Project believes that the bill is too broadly drafted to address the issues that caused us to need a fix in this, and the Dash 2 amendments that we're proposing are a narrower fix to the problem that we believe will address the issues raised by the County Council's opinion and the Court of Appeals in the Thompson case. We do believe that if the bill passed, the engrossed version bill were to be passed, that it would be unconstitutional because it would allow for the adult jailing of juveniles who had only been tried in juvenile court and had not been provided with a jury trial or other due process prerequisites for adult treatment. And we also believe that it could lead to costly class action. And for that reason, we would encourage you to adopt the Dash 2 amendments. Those amendments basically just leave in language that was already in the bill that addressed the problems of defining who is an adult for purposes of these statutes and who is a juvenile for purposes of these statutes. And so the bill already contains that language, and the language that we delete in our amendments is the language that allows for juveniles who've been tried in juvenile court and turn 18 to be then transferred to an adult jail, which we believe is unconstitutional.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Przanski.
We're still waiting to hear about the A3s.
Oh, Mr. I can answer that. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. The A3s, the A4s are a technical superseding A3s. So we got it now. That's right. A4s are the revamped version of the A3s.
Any other questions?
I want to get back to the A2s. Tim, it sounds like these may have been discussed at one time over in the Senate. Can you share with us why you would differ with Ms. McFarland as to the constitutional issues that she believes may be waiting in a wait if we don't do the A2s?
We had a, perhaps you were excused that day, we had a very lengthy debate here about that in front of this committee. Essentially, the law upon which Ms. McFarlane relies is very old. There have been a great many changes statutorily to juvenile law, notably Senate Bill 1, since the time of that that decision. We believe that the moving on from the parents patriae model in juvenile court to the current model, which is a combination of public account, public safety, accountability, and rehabilitation, replacing the best interest of the child standard, which was the standard that was in place at the time of that decision. We believe that when you're talking about someone who is over the age of 18 years old, who a judge has found that the treatment needs that this person has will be met in that adult lockup, that you're not violating the constitutional right, because the constitutional right is a right to treatment, and they're going to get whatever treatment the court deems is appropriate, even though they are in this adult setting. They are not being moved out of juvenile court jurisdiction. They're still a youth offender under the jurisdiction of the juvenile court. The only thing that is different is that they are being placed in an adult lockup. And if the treatment needs of that individual person are not met by that adult lockup, the judge has to find that they will be, or else they won't be placed there. So it's not a waiver. We're not bootstrapping anyone into the adult system.
Ms. McFarland.
Thank you, Chair Anderson, Representative Prezanski. Mr. Travis likes to refer to the Tewksbury decision as an old decision, but the fact is that it's still good law and that there is no case law that allows a juvenile, someone who's been adjudicated in a juvenile court, to then be transferred to an adult setting, an adult criminal correction setting, without the due process rights of jury trial and bail and so forth. And that's what this bill does. And it's a very simple constitutional matter. We still do have the due process clause despite whatever changes we've made in our juvenile system. It's there, and it provides some basic protections for everyone. And I think that it is an oversimplification to say, and not to mention terribly unrealistic, to say that all that's required is that then the juveniles get the treatment to which they are entitled and which they need in adult court, because that's not all that the quid pro quo of trading off not having a jury trial, not having other due process rights in juvenile court requires. It also requires a special solicitude. And in the Tewksbury decision, the Federal District Court for the District of Oregon found specifically that that special solicitude does not exist in an adult jail.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Prezanski.
I wonder if it would be appropriate to ask counsel if he could actually check in with LC regarding these two amendments. I mean, to me, there's some striking arguments to be made here, and I do not know this area. And we're talking about potentially putting, the system at risk. And it'd be nice to have a little clarity from our legal counsel.
Sure.
So, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I just want to clarify something, if I may, with Ms. McFarlane, and that is the dash A2 amendments then take the bill back to being the original Senate Bill 19. Is that correct?
Chair Anderson and Representative Krummel, no, they don't. The original bill also contained provision allowing for the placement of juveniles who had reached their 18th birthday in adult jails. So actually, Mr. Travis made the amendments that resulted in the A engrossed version, and I think it was to, and I don't want to put words in, but I believe it was to simplify the language that was in the original version.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chair. And Tim, I don't know if you want to weigh in on this, but because the way I'm reading the A2s, if I'm reading them correctly, is that basically you strip all of the new language out, and so there isn't really much of a bill left. And quite frankly, if we were going to adopt the A2s, we could just basically kill the bill, and we wouldn't have to worry about it at all.
I would like to weigh in on that. But you want to go first?
If I could. Representative Anderson and Representative Crummell. We would not want you to do that because there is still a problem that has to be fixed here. And the things that are left in the bill are the provisions that occur in several sections that define what is an adult and what is a juvenile for purposes of these sections. So, you know, I think that Mr. Travis and the other supporters of the bill and I are in agreement that we do need to have a fix because of County Council's opinion, and the Thompson case by the Court of Appeals have made this unclear, and we now need to clarify this. And they have done that. And what legislative council did with drafting the amendments was to leave their language in where it was appropriate to make that change. So we do need that change, and we need this bill, but we would like to see it without the ability to place juveniles who have reached their 18th birthday in adult facilities.
Okay. And if I may, we would, if that was going to happen, we would still like the A4 amendments to be passed, those technical pieces. The piece that Julie is talking about is, as I have said many times in front of this committee, the words in juvenile law don't mean what you think they mean. And the way that now adult is defined in the ORS is confusing to people, because an adult in juvenile delinquency law is someone who is under the jurisdiction of the adult criminal court. A person can be 18 years of age, and if they're under the jurisdiction of the juvenile court, they are not an adult, according to the statutes. They are in your mind. They are in my mind, and that's the confusion that needs to be straightened out. We need that definition of adult to say under the jurisdiction of the adult criminal court, and youth offender to be someone who's under the jurisdiction of the juvenile court, regardless of their age. You can be 16 years of age and be an adult, and you can be 16 years of age and be a juvenile offender. It depends on whether you're a Measure 11 defendant or whether you're not a Measure 11 but a defendant under some other statute. So we need to straighten that out.
Thank you.
Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. I wanted to clarify one other thing, too. You, Mr. Representative Crummell, you asked if the A2s were what the Senate considered. They came after, and I think it's... Now, Julie, I see Kathy Berger was neutral on the bill in the Senate, and also wasn't the work group that Carl Myers organized, wasn't JRP represented on that work group? And how do you fit into those two things?
Representative Anderson, Mr. Prinz, yes, indeed, we were on that work group, and we expressed at the public hearing, and it was Ms. Berger who was on the work group, and Ms. Berger who attended the public hearing on the Senate side, and she did express our concerns. It was not until after the Senate hearing that we decided to proceed and propose this amendment and pursue it. So we've always taken the position in this that we opposed the idea of putting 18-year-olds who were adjudicated within the juvenile court into adult lockups. And we had hoped through the process that we would be able to work out something that was agreeable to everyone, but we were not.
Okay. Any other questions? I think considering the need to adjudicate these two questions as far as constitutionality, we will not continue with a work session today. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 19. Let us take 304, Senate Bill. Oh, you're ready now? Yes, sir. And that's bills. Okay, we will go to Senate Bill 269 instead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 269 prohibits employers of the Office of Emergency Management from striking or recognizing a picket line. I had some conversations with some of the interested parties about this bill last week, and there are some questions as to the status of the Office of Emergency Management, whether it's standalone or not, and that has an impact on whether the bill is necessary. So I assume that Mary
and Hugh Thurman can speak to that. But I'm not sure if we ever resolved that issue or if we still think that the bill should go forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin with AFSCME, Council 75. And at the beginning of the session, the Office of Emergency Management was a standalone agency. And in reviewing the duties that they were being expected to assume under the Homeland Security provisions passed down by the federal government, it made an incredible amount of sense to us that they should be moved into a non-strikeable unit, mostly because these are, by and large, many first responders. You know, that this is the work that they do is all about emergency management in its broadest sense of the terms, whether you're talking about floods or fires or some kind of domestic terrorism. It is this group that is responsible for the first action. And under the previous administration, Governor Kitzhaber had seen fit to move them into a standalone agency simply because of their kind of unique status. The current governor has not seen fit to continue that status and has now moved them back under the control of the Oregon State Police. This has created a conflict for us about exactly how this is going to work and what the practical implications are. And Mr. Murphy and I are we're kind of struggling to figure out where we go from here, and we'd like the committee to not move the bill today, but rather give us a few days to kind of sort out all the cards and see where it's going to end up falling out at this point.
Mr. Murphy, would you like to
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ken Murphy. I'm the Director of Oregon Emergency Management, and Mary Botkin is absolutely correct. There's actually two issues that have changed. One, as she stated, that the Office of Emergency Management under Governor Kulongowski decided to put us back in under the state police structure. And the second thing, one of our groups in our organization is the Oregon Emergency Response System, and there's about four folks in that group right now, and they're one of the key elements that this bill would support. And we were trying to economize our forces with the law enforcement data system, 24-hour operations, and in that we discovered that they handle sensitive criminal information, and part of their regulations that govern them in the CFRs is that they must be part of a law enforcement agency. So currently right now there's a proposal to take these four people out of emergency management and move them into law enforcement data systems, which again causes confusion with this bill. So as Mary stated, would ask your indulgence that we go back and try and unravel or fix this bill and not take up your time here.
Any questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
With that, we will not move the bill, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 269A. And with that, I believe our work is complete. Did you have anything on 59 that was not ready?
It's not ready.
Yeah, no, I don't, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. All right. And did we do those?